Seemingly endless rows of cars line up waiting for food in San Antonio. We'll check out the strain on efforts to feed the hungry in other parts of Texas today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown, a tool used to recover memories lost to trauma, acceptable for use in police work. An investigative report by the Dallas Morning News about the use of hypnosis in criminal cases. Also, life in the federal lockup now under lockdown amid growing concerns for prison populations and staff, and how a pandemic affects a political push to flip the Texas House. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets started. That happens right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 13th day of April 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us, and we certainly hope your weekend was a nice one. By now, you might have seen this, a photograph for the San Antonio Express News showing unending queues of cars snaking back and forth line upon line, tens of thousands of families waiting to pick up boxes of food from the San Antonio Food Bank. It was an image all the more jarring for the typical lack of traffic on our roads right now, and a stark reminder that beneath the relative quiet and calm are lots of folks hurting and worried about where their next meal's going to come from. The ripple effect of closing businesses to maintain social distancing is hitting people who live paycheck to paycheck especially hard. But that impact, at least, is getting public attention, and as we'll hear later in the broadcast, many neighbors in Texas are trying to help out, too. But when we talk about shelter in place, what if you don't have a shelter? Texans who are homeless are seldom at the top of the list when it comes to prioritizing public resources or public attention, yet they are among the most vulnerable populations during a pandemic. Here to talk with us about how the homeless population in different parts of Texas are affected and the impact on efforts to feed the hungry, experts from three different parts of the Lone Star State. First, Austin City Councilwoman Ann Kitchen. Welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
Lubbock City Councilwoman Latrell Joy is also on the line. Latrell, welcome back to the Standard.
Happy to be here.
And we have the president and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance, Carl Falconer. Carl, good to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's begin with a basic question here. And I believe, Ms. Kitchen, if we can start with you. How has COVID-19 affected the city of Austin? And how what are you hearing from your experts?
We have to really think about how we improve our services for homeless people. So that means, how do we distribute food so people don't have to hunt for food daily? How do we provide shelf-stable foods, tuna packets, milk cartons, pre-cooked packets, soups and protein bars, things like that? It's how you distribute it so that people can most efficiently get access to food. So they're not having, you know, homeless people generally have to look every day for food. We need to help them stay in place.
Councilwoman Joy, what are you seeing there in Lubbock?
We're seeing good things here in the midst of all of this. We have one agency that has 78 people in little houses, and their plan is working exactly the way it should. They provide three meals a day. So food apparently is fairly easily accessed, but we've not had any outbreaks among our homeless population in terms of COVID-19.
That is good news indeed. What about in Dallas, Carl Falconer? What is the Homeless Alliance seeing?
Really, what we're looking at in Dallas is three levels of homeless groups that we're working with. The at-risk homeless population, which affecting a lot of people because of layoffs, unemployment, and not being able to pay their rent and things like that. And then we have the sheltered population, which the city of Dallas has opened our convention center as an overflow shelter for those that want to be sheltered or can be sheltered at this time. And then our unsheltered population, which is people who are still out on the street, we can't necessarily get to them as quickly. So we're trying to deal with all three of them kind of at the same time. And we think that depending on the day and depending on the time as this goes on, each population will have some different needs there. But so far, we've been doing a pretty good job, and I'll echo kind of what the Lubbock City Councilwoman said is, so far we haven't had any real big outbreaks. We have three people, I think at last count, that we had quarantined just who were symptomatic. Don't believe we have any positive tests yet.
I have to say that I'm struck. It's great news to hear, certainly in Dallas and Lubbock, which I say surprising because, of course, there are issues of just basic hygiene when you don't have shelter, you don't have access to soap and water, right? What about the spread of the virus here in Austin among people who don't have access to some of these basic resources?
Well, we're similar. I think we've had maybe one person test positive. But what we're doing, to speak to what you just said, is we have mobile hygiene clinics that provide for showers, hand washing, and a bathroom. And we've placed them throughout the city for our unsheltered homeless folks. That's so important to have access to that kind of hand washing and showers. And so that's one of the things that we have done. We also have a motel for quarantine purposes. So to the extent that people are particularly vulnerable or they may have been exposed or they may be showing symptoms, we have a motel that they can stay in. We're also ramping up our approach to be more permanent and long-term, and that is to purchase motels that we can then turn into long-term housing. Because at the end of the day, we want to make these improvements in services, and we want our unsheltered folks not to go back to being homeless.
Ms. Joy, in Lubbock, I know that in a lot of more rural towns and cities in Texas, you don't have a massive infrastructure to help people who don't have a shelter. You have to rely a lot on volunteers. Do you have that kind of resource you can tap into at a time when everyone's supposed to be sheltering in place?
Yes. All of the groups are utilizing their volunteers. Of course, they have to be careful about that. And I will say this, Grace Campus that has the little houses, their people are still going to work. Everybody's masking up and a good hygiene, and they're going on to their job because their goal is to have them into permanent housing.
You know, the fact that so many people who have had jobs are now suddenly without, I'm wondering if Mr. Falconer in Dallas, if you're bracing yourself for another wave of demand for the services that the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance provides.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I had mentioned before, the at-risk homeless population has, we really think there's going to be a big wave coming at us of people who are just living on the edge, who may have had their own housing, but were one paycheck or 1 month's worth of paychecks away from becoming homeless. Right now, we're really bracing for that. And I think some of the CARES Act funding that's coming from the federal government, that's some of the discussion we're having now, is how to be able to use those funds to prevent people from becoming homeless, as well as, like the councilwoman from Austin talked about, thinking about other longer-term solutions for some of our homeless individuals and getting them moved into housing eventually.
If someone wants to help, what's the best thing they can do? Mr. Falconer, you were just talking, so what would you tell someone who wants to find out the single best thing that they can do right now?
I think you can reach out to your cities, your counties, or your providers and just ask them what their needs are. A lot of foundations are putting together different packages and stuff to try and help people.
Lubbock, Latrell, Joy, what do you need there?
I think I concur with the gentleman from Dallas. I would also say we have a homelessness consortium here. Mm-hmm. If people need information, we have someone there to provide that information to them.
How can people help in the city of Austin, Councilwoman Kitchen?
Well, what they can do is they can make a donation. Small or large, it doesn't matter. What is not helpful is to go out and provide food for homeless individuals directly. Mm-hmm. That puts everybody at risk. Austin's on lockdown, and we are doing our best to flatten the curve. And so it's very important that everyone limit their contact with other individuals.
What's missing from this conversation about homelessness in Texas? Lubbock, Latrell?
Well, I would also say social distancing is extremely important, regardless of who you are, or where you may be living. And so masking and social distancing has to happen. And so we just need to keep reminding everyone about that.
Yeah. And then I would just add, we kind of touched on this. We need to come out of this with better resources. Mm-hmm. We need to turn this into an opportunity to improve the services we have and the infrastructure we have so that people are better able to weather a pandemic or any other kind of emergency.
And I think the other thing I would hope is that the community can now understand that housing is healthcare. The initial comments and guidance that the CDC was putting out across the country was to shelter in place. Mm-hmm. And just like you had mentioned before, how do you do that when you don't have a place to shelter?
Right.
You don't have a house. And I think that's the biggest thing, is if the community can start to understand that homelessness affects more than just an individual. It affects the community, and it is more than just four walls and a roof. It is healthcare for people in these circumstances. And in other circumstances, it's so much more.
This pandemic is about the entire community, and we're all working together to prevent the spread. And so, as you just said, having a place to live, a place to stay, is part of helping to prevent the spread of the pandemic. And it, as you said so eloquently, this just highlights that housing is healthcare.
We've been talking about the homeless population in three different parts of Texas. Austin City Councilwoman Ann Kitchen, Lubbock City Councilwoman Latrell Joy, and the President and CEO of the Metro Dallas Homeless Alliance, Carl Falconer. Thank you all so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us on The Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wells Dunbar, our social media editor. How was your weekend, Wells?
Michael today, David. A little change in the schedule on you.
Ho, ho, ho. Hey, good to hear from you. How was your weekend, Michael?
Not too bad, David. Just wanted to springboard off that conversation, though, as you take a look through social media. You know, it doesn't take long to find folks describing their own experience, either with being homeless or being on the verge, as we just heard. A lot of those service providers for folks who are homeless expecting an uptick in demand because, yeah, you know, they've lost their jobs, they've lost security,
sure,
because of COVID-19. This tweet from Twitter user Dot Wonders in San Marcos speaks to that. They say, "I don't get the stimulus check because I'm a college student. My single mom covers my insurance. I'm facing homelessness on April 30th. Here's another one. This one from Twitter user Language Witch in El Paso. She describes herself as a person who's autistic and disabled. She says, in part, she's facing homelessness because I'm too sick to work full time. I've been denied Medicaid, just lost my part-time job. Who's going to hire a 40-something disabled person?" Several more like that, David. Really tough stuff, and I think it speaks to the level of difficulty that some folks are facing.
Indeed. We would love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on Twitter or your social media platform of choice. Michael Marks is looking for you. He'll be back at 35.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Earlier this year, two national gun control organizations announced an unprecedented $8 million campaign. Its aim? To flip the Texas State House to the Democrats and to elect what they called gun sense candidates to the U.S. House. Then COVID-19 struck the state. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider takes a look at how the pandemic may affect the campaign and the fall elections.
A May Mobley Turney may not fit the image of a gun control activist, or gun safety activist as she prefers. For starters, the head of Houston's Moms Demand Action chapter is herself a gun owner.
I have a 410 and a 20-gauge shotgun myself. With my gun, it's locked in a closet and there's no ammunition in the gun, and the guns are for hunting. And I would hope that if you're a gun owner, that you're storing your guns properly as well.
Turney says once she's able to establish a common ground, she finds it easier to get gun owners to listen to her. She's confident that she and others like her will be able to meet the national goals of Moms Demand Action and its partner, Everytown for Gun Safety. Turney became an activist after the Columbine mass shooting, and for years she wasn't able to get any traction in Texas. But she says with the string of mass shootings here, that's changing. She cites an internal poll.
86% of Texas voters support background checks on all gun sales. But a majority of Texans don't believe that elected officials have done enough to prevent mass shootings.
The two national organizations claim to have 400,000 grassroots volunteers in Texas. In the Houston area, they're looking to flip 8 state House seats and 3 U.S. House seats. They also aim to protect gains from the 2018 election.
This is something we have been preparing for since the 2018 election losses.
Mike Cox is a hill country rancher and the legislative director of the Texas State Rifle Association. He says Beto O'Rourke's popularity was a wake-up call.
We lost 12 House of Representative members as a result of that race. All those seats are now occupied by anti-gun Democrats. Getting those seats back is our focus.
Now, the COVID-19 pandemic could upend things. For one thing, public events and door knocking are out. Phone banking and social media may make up some of the difference, but then there's the question of how focused voters will be on issues other than survival and the economy. Elizabeth Simas, political scientist at the University of Houston, says not much.
Gun control regulations are an interesting thing. Public opinion in support of them tends to spike anytime there is a major incident or a mass shooting of some sort. And if schools aren't in session, if people aren't having large meetings in churches and in shopping malls and concerts and all these other places, then we're not having mass shootings.
Add to that, in the wake of the pandemic, gun and ammunition sales are spiking. Again, Mike Cox.
We view this preparation reasonable and predictable. How many first responders will become infected? Will anybody come if we call 911?
Amay Mobley Turney says she doesn't want to be dismissive of anyone purchasing guns right now because of concerns about their safety, but she's convinced that she and her fellow activists will make the difference.
Anybody running for office should look at Virginia. 6 months after that shooting in Virginia Beach that left 12 people dead and 4 people injured, the Virginia State House legislators who failed to support gun safety were voted out of office by a block of largely suburban voters.
The Texas campaign is targeting the Houston and Dallas suburbs, areas politically and demographically similar to those that flipped in Virginia in 2019. In Houston, I'm Andrew Schneider.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a health and safety-focused workers' compensation provider, reminding Texans that the best way to stick together right now is to stay apart. More at texasmutual.com/coronavirus.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. It goes without saying it's been a tough couple of months for the economy. That holds especially true for the energy industry, which began to feel the crunch from COVID-19 early on as oil demand dipped along with global travel. That got compounded by a price war half a world away hitting the home front, i.e. Texas, doubly hard. But it might not be all gloom and doom for the energy market as a whole right now. Here with more is energy insider Matt Smith. He's director of commodity research at Clipper Data. Matt, welcome back.
Thank you, David.
Now, you know, we think of the energy industry here in Texas largely as the oil industry, but that's not the case, of course. I'm wondering if we're seeing the same awful headlines for renewable energy as we've been seeing for the oil market.
Well, David, in kind of keeping with trying to bring some good news to the world, we are seeing some better news coming out of the renewable side of things. Now, granted, you know, we are seeing renewable energy getting swept up in the chaos and confusion and disruption caused by the coronavirus. So projects are being delayed, all that. But we have had some glimpses of good news in terms of headlines in the last week. So one just in the New York Times, which ran saying oil companies are collapsing, but wind and solar energy keep growing. While the Financial Times over there in Blighty in London, they said they had a piece called Texas, How the Home of U.S. Oil and Gas Fell in Love with Solar Power.
That's interesting. Now, before we get to solar, I love how you use Blighty. Nice use of the word Blighty. I want to get back to this idea of solar power in a moment. But wind power, I've always thought of Texas as being one of the national leaders. And I guess that's still true. Is it also true that a wind farm in Texas is beginning commercial operations, something new?
Yeah, and you're exactly right there, David. So in terms of the power gen mix in Texas, wind accounts for about 20%, sort of neck and neck with coal, whereas solar is only 1%. But there is this really interesting, this wind farm. It's called the Sage Draw Wind Farm in West Texas. And it's got a capacity of 338 megawatts, and it's just started commercial operations. What it is, it's part of a PPA. Now, PPA stands for a power purchase agreement, and that has been made by ExxonMobil. And what they've done essentially over the next 12 years, they're buying 500 megawatt hours of capacity for wind and solar power, somewhat ironically to use to produce oil in the Permian Basin. But set that aside for the moment. They're aiming to essentially meet 70% of their power demand via renewables.
That's fascinating. Are anyone else other than ExxonMobil getting in on that sort of power swapping arrangement?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we hear a lot about the tech companies leading on this type of thing. But it's kind of running the gamut, really. So we've got Google, McDonald's, Wells Fargo, among some of these companies that are committing to buy power from Texas solar plants. While IKEA actually has just purchased 49% stakes in two solar projects. One's in Utah and one is in Texas. The Texas park is called Missay, and it's just come online in the last month. And it's using more than 823,000 solar panels. And so
that's
this
insane.
Is just part of IKEA's effort. 823,000. That's an awful lot, isn't it?
Yeah. You'd think that Texas would be, though, even more of a leader in solar, given all those wide open spaces out west.
And I think, yeah, that's something that we're going to be seeing coming through. Even just, for example, with IKEA, you know, they're looking to cover 100% of their total power demand with renewables by 2025. We're having these other commitments from other companies, from Exxon to Google to Apple, McDonald's, etc. And so this is something that should become more prevalent in the years to come.
Matt Smith is Director of Commodity Research at Clipper Data, originally from Old Blighty, as he might say. Matt, thanks again. We'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks, David. Take care.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, whose fight against cancer includes telemedicine. At home, virtual visits with doctors help patients keep appointments while continuing to practice safe social distancing. Learn more at TexasOncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Terrazas. Texas abortion providers are asking the U.S. Supreme Court to allow their clinics to continue performing some procedures during the coronavirus pandemic. It's the latest step in an ongoing legal battle over an executive order Governor Greg Abbott issued last month. It halted all procedures that were not immediately medically necessary. He said that includes abortions. Abortion providers argue the procedure is time-sensitive. They also point out medication abortions should be allowed to continue because they involve limited personal protective equipment. Meanwhile, Governor Abbott is extending the state's disaster declaration for another month as the number of COVID-19 cases in Texas keeps climbing. KERA's Rachel Osier-Lindley has more.
In a statement Sunday, Governor Abbott said, quote, "By extending my disaster declaration, we are ensuring the state of Texas continues to have adequate resources and capabilities to support our communities and protect public health," end quote. The disaster declaration covers all Texas counties and extends Abbott's original March 13th order for another 30 days. To slow the spread of COVID-19, Abbott also urged all Texans to continue practicing social distancing and to follow CDC guidelines.
According to state data, nearly 13,500 cases of COVID-19 have been confirmed in Texas. At least 271 fatalities are linked to the virus. The San Antonio Food Bank is planning another mega drive-through giveaway this Friday as demand spikes amid the outbreak. Texas Public Radio's Brian Kirkpatrick reports their giveaway at the end of last week drew 10,000 people.
Food Bank President and CEO Eric Cooper says the large giveaways are needed because the smaller pantries it operates are simply overrun by demand. Many of their volunteers are staying home during the outbreak.
They've seen twice the demand that they normally see, going from feeding 60,000 people a week to now over 120. In efforts to mitigate the traffic flow at the pantries and to get families fresh produce, the San Antonio Food Bank went to a mega distribution.
Cooper says participants must pre-register online at safoodbank.org. Food bank officials say pre-registered visitors at the drive-thru can keep traffic moving by staying in their vehicles during the process and clear out trunk space in advance. I'm Brian Kirkpatrick in San Antonio.
Willie Nelson and other musicians are raising awareness and funds for family farmers struggling due to the current public health crisis. Nelson and his sons, Lucas and Micah, perform Saturday night as part of the virtual concert At Home with Farm Aid. That audio is courtesy of Access TV. Nelson's fellow FarmAid co-founders, Neil Young and John Mellencamp, also performed. I'm Lauren Terrazas for the Texas Standard.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For decades, few questioned how police officers use certain methods to prove someone committed a crime, so long as it was science, right? Well, not all of it was. That's the problem. You see, many techniques used by law enforcement have been put to the test in courts and in laboratories over the years and found to be junk. From the so-called fire science, used to convict and execute Cameron Todd Willingham here in Texas, to the bite mark evidence used in countless cases, or even how officers have claimed splatters of blood point to one suspect or another. Well, now comes another instrument from police investigators' tool bags, hypnosis, to help build a case against a suspect. Here to talk about the technique are Dallas Morning News investigative reporters Lauren McGaughey and Dave Boucher. Welcome to the Texas Standard, both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Lauren, let's begin with you. In clinical settings, I know hypnosis has been used to help people remember traumatic events. It seems that it would have at least some kind of practical use for a police investigator, too, if you're trying to get someone to remember whether or not something happened, right?
That's the argument that investigative hypnotists make. These are law enforcement agents who are not medical or healthcare professionals, but who have taken a one-week course in investigative hypnosis. And they make the argument that hypnotizing a victim or a witness to a crime helps them relax so they can better recall details of that crime. The problem is that there's no evidence that shows that hypnosis actually makes your memories any sharper, and in fact, it can implant false memories in your mind without you even knowing it.
Dave, what do the courts have to say about this? Has this been tested very much?
You know, it's been tested in different cases all across the country, and the results have really been all over the map. You know, we focus on a specific case in our story, but if that crime and case were brought in 21 other states, judges would essentially throw out the evidence because courts all across the country have decided that evidence gleaned through a hypnosis session is just too unreliable. And this all comes back to hypnosis being based in suggestion. You mentioned a clinical setting. If, you know, you go in to try and stop being afraid of something or to quit smoking, the hypnotist will tell you or suggest to you that you don't want to smoke. But if you're a police officer, you can't suggest something to a witness or to a crime victim because that taints the evidence.
Lauren, I want to get back to something you said. You said that sometimes these forensic hypnotists have had like a week of training or so. Describe how this was used in this case against an SMU security guard that y'all are writing about.
Sure. In the case that we look at, it's a case from the late 80s in Dallas, and there was an SMU student who was attacked in her bed, and she could not pick her attacker out of a lineup. They botched the investigation. There was no physical evidence that was recovered from the scene that was helpful. And so they turned to hypnosis, and a Dallas police detective actually hypnotized the victim. And it was only after that hypnosis session that she was able to pick who she said attacked her out of a lineup. That man was arrested. And to find out what happened in the case, you're going to have to read the story. But, you know, we spoke with several experts who said today that that wouldn't even fly even here in Texas, or they hope it wouldn't fly, because there was absolutely no physical evidence tying this man to the crime. It was all based on often an identification made post-hypnosis.
You say today it wouldn't fly. Is it still being used by investigators anywhere in Texas?
It is still being used, and that's the big wrinkle here. Whereas many other states have said that this evidence isn't admissible in court anymore, it is admissible here in Texas. And so law enforcement agents in Texas are still turning to hypnosis sessions to put victims and witnesses under a hypnotic trance. And in fact, the Texas Rangers, who've used it almost a couple thousand times over the last 40 years, turned to it in October to investigate a murder case. So hypnosis is still alive and well amongst the police in Texas.
A quick question, Dave, and we're out of time. Time just zipped by, but It's one thing if an investigator wants to use this to maybe follow a lead. It's quite another if you want to use this as evidence in a case. Are judges permitting this hypnosis evidence in cases in Texas, even if investigators are still using it?
Yeah, they definitely are. There's case law, so a precedent that was established in the late 1980s in Texas that sort of set out like a framework that prosecutors and police have to follow in order to get this evidence into court. But Texas courts have affirmed that. And they've said, yep, if you follow these guidelines, then you're allowed to put somebody on the stand who was previously hypnotized.
It's a riveting read that folds together all sorts of issues, including how we know what we think we know and the way that criminal justice works, certainly here in Texas. Read all about it in the Sunday edition of the Dallas Morning News or check it out online at dallasnews.com. Lauren McGaughey, Dave Boucher, investigative reporters for the Dallas Morning News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
My name is Linda Watson, and I'm a 60-year-old grumpy old hillbilly. We live in Lubbock, Texas, which is about the middle of the panhandle of Texas. For the last 35 years, I have been in the wild animal rescue business. Before that, for most of my life, I was a cowboy, which seems counterproductive to now I'm saving prairie dogs, but that's another long story. You know, we don't start moving the prairie dogs unless it's an extreme emergency until about June. So I'm not anticipating any great problems with that. Now, I can see where I might, if this continues, be having a little bit of problem in locating the types of fresh fruits and vegetables and things that we feed them, but we can do a workaround. It's okay. I mean, the great thing about this is they eat grass. So worst case scenario, old Linda's going to be out in the, you know, in the fields cutting grass or hiring every kid in the neighborhood to bring me buckets of grass to feed it. You know, we've all got to do our part, and right now the least of my worries is the food for prairie dogs several months in the future. What we've been doing here, trying to do shopping for some of the families that we know of that have, you know, folks that have we got two families with cancer, one that's doing dialysis, and you know, a couple of diabetic families. These people don't even need to be going to the grocery store. So what we've basically been doing is playing COVID roulette. That's where you disinfect yourself thoroughly, go to the store, get what these folks need, come home, disinfect it, disinfect yourself and deliver it, and just don't take any chances and do the very best you can. Everybody do your part, and sometimes if your part is just staying home, that's your part. You do things because it's the right thing to do. That's why you do things. If we all do one nice thing to somebody else every day, even if it's just speaking nicely to somebody in the checkout line, this world would be a whole lot better place. And it's not hard. It really isn't. To do the right thing, be a good person. This is Linda Watson, and you're listening to the Texas Standard. Have a good day.
43 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Millions of Americans have had their economic livelihoods upended by COVID-19. As positive cases continue to rise in Texas, more cities and more counties have been taking measures like restricting mass gatherings and closing business to slow the spread of the virus. These moves have upended the lives of many, especially those who rely on tips and people with gigs and part-time jobs. Texas Public Radio's Rinaldo Leaños Jr. takes a look at how some residents of the Rio Grande Valley are trying to raise some cash for those affected.
Pedro Rodriguez is a freelance DJ in the Rio Grande Valley. He's known as Flacucho, a slang word for skinny. And for several years, the rhythm of his life has sounded like this.
For me, it's just kind of just bringing people together.
He says March is usually the busiest month for DJs in the Valley, especially at the legendary spring break town of South Padre Island. But this year, things are different. COVID-19 happened.
I was like super disappointed and just kind of like bummed because I rely on, you know, my gigs for like income security and like survival. And so I can't do what I do for a living because of this virus.
I spoke with him over the phone. He's practicing social distancing. Just like his clients, he says all of his gigs have been postponed or just flat out canceled.
You know, my brother's a musician as well. You know, he can't play any gigs because the venues and the bars are shut down. So there's no outlets for DJs and musicians and also for bartenders and servers to go ahead and work.
Now, he doesn't know when his next paid gig will be.
That's already like my month's rent and my car payment just like down the drain, you know. So that was like one huge like setback for me.
Pedro is one of many in the gig industry who rely on tips and part-time work to make ends meet. This industry is getting decimated by the virus.
We're going to be impacted at a much bigger rate.
Vicente Martinez Jr. lives in Brownsville. He saw an opportunity to step up and try to help his community deal with the virus.
I wanted to take action.
Vicente knew people were being laid off, but he wasn't exactly sure how to start helping people until he stumbled across something surprising on social media.
But I saw someone who's an organizer in Austin actually create a Austin virtual tip jar. So I was thinking about creating something of that nature.
A virtual tip jar. This is how it works. It's an online spreadsheet with many names and employment titles and a link to everyone's Venmo or Cash App accounts. On this list, you'll find waiters, performing artists, retail workers, anyone whose jobs are dependent on tips or hourly work.
So they'll provide that information, and whenever I have a chance, I'll compile that information and add it to their Excel sheet where people can access the information.
You choose who you want to help out and send money directly to them. Vicente manages this list and adds new names throughout the day. The spreadsheet, which now has more than 100 people on the list, then gets shared on social media. And people are able to share whatever amount they want. Someone who has also been impacted by the virus and the tip jar is Alina Jimenez.
So it really stressed me out.
She's a server at Texas Roadhouse in College Station and a student at Texas A&M. Jimenez says her hours were drastically cut as the restaurant began taking only to-go orders.
So I figured that it'd be a lot more beneficial to come home and be with my family during this time. Especially because I do have an elderly grandmother here and I wanted to make sure that she had somebody to take care of her.
She says her mom is struggling too. She had to shut down the salon she owns. Alina says life has been stressful, but she finally received a virtual tip.
I almost stopped my steps and like started crying because I was like there's just such good-hearted people out there that are willing to do that for you, especially knowing that like, you know, we all have our own things going on in our own lives. And for someone to really take the time out of their day and actually, you know, like pay it forward.
She's received about $20 since her name got on the list, but Alina says she's grateful for any amount that comes her way. Pedro, who we heard from earlier, says he hasn't received any money yet. Both of them and others are expected to be getting some help from the government soon. The federal government passed a stimulus bill that would give people across the country who make less than $75,000 a one-time check of $1,200. Alina and Pedro, in the meantime, will continue to look out if they receive more tips while they figure out how to pay for their bills. I'm Reynaldo Leaños Jr. in Mission.
Well, some 50,000 Northeast Texans were reported without power at last check after storms swept the region Sunday. Upshur Rural Electric Cooperative reports extensive damage to infrastructure as straight-line winds uprooted trees that fell on power lines in Longview. About 18,000 people are without power after winds hit more than 50 miles an hour, one of several stories we're tracking here on the Texas Standard.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. All 146,000 people locked up in federal prisons are under a two-week lockdown to stem the spread of coronavirus. More than 400 inmates and workers across the federal prison system have tested positive. Eight have died. KERA's Christopher Connolly talked with some folks affected by the lockdown at a prison in Fort Worth.
Life on lockdown is frustrating, and it's scary, says Mindy Forbes. She's serving time at Federal Medical Facility Carswell. It's a prison holding more than 1,600 women who have special medical and mental health needs.
We have ran out of toilet paper. We've ran out of pads. We've had no soap for our bathrooms. We get out one time a day for 10 minutes. We walk to the chow hall. We come back with a hot lunch, and we come back with bologna every night.
Tensions are running high with no scheduled recreation or activities. Forbes says there are about 250 women in her housing unit, but only about 120 chairs. They sleep four to a cell, less than 3 feet apart. Everyone's expected to wear the same disposable mask every day. The phones are in pretty heavy use, but Forbes hasn't seen anyone sanitize them.
Basically, I just wiped it off myself on my shirt, hoping not to get it. We are not implementing anything that should be implemented.
Even scarier, the unit across the hall was put under quarantine because of a suspected coronavirus case, Forbes says. But officers still move between that quarantined unit and hers.
So whatever they've got, we're going to have.
A Bureau of Prisons case tracker shows only one inmate has tested positive at the facility, though earlier this month, KXAS-TV reported that a pregnant inmate in her 30s was rushed to a hospital for an emergency C-section. She's now in critical care on a ventilator. The baby, born premature, was doing well, according to the report. Administrators at Carswell did not respond to requests for comment.
The conditions are bad for us. We're all really scared. They're not telling us anything.
Forbes is serving a 20-year sentence for conspiring to launder money from illegal marijuana sales. She has pernicious anemia, which can weaken the immune system, and says Carswell is a medical prison facility filled with women who are elderly, pregnant, or have chronic conditions that make them especially vulnerable. A lawyer by training, Forbes has been helping women in her unit file motions for release. Many, she says, are nonviolent first-time offenders like her.
They need to be released on ankle monitors or home confinement. And they are not bad people. But if we leave them here in this petri dish, there's a possibility they could all die and they did not get life sentences.
Late last month, Attorney General Bill Barr sent a memo ordering the release of some elderly, vulnerable, and low-risk people from federal prisons. Since then, about 900 people have been let out to home confinement.
We have 10,000 inmates over 60. Generally speaking, about a third of our inmates have pre-existing conditions.
For people with loved ones inside the prison, lockdown means communication is extra challenging, says Brittany Winner. Her sister, Reality Winner, is locked up in Carswell for leaking a classified document.
And for me, the powerlessness of not always knowing whether she's safe or healthy or what is going to happen to her next. I mean, we're all suffering here, even on the outside.
Winner says her sister struggles with severe anxiety and other mental health issues, and being locked in means she doesn't get the daily hour of recreation that helps her stay centered.
On a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is the worst, Normally, she's at about a 7. Now, I'd say she's at a 12.
Winner says it feels like her sister and all the people locked down in the federal prison system are being given an extra punishment beyond their sentence, even if it's being done in the name of public health.
It is easy to look at people who are in prison and think, well, they deserve it. They belong in there. They've done something bad. Well, somebody still loves them.
Which is why she says as many people as possible need to be released as quickly as possible. I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Monitoring the talk of Texas on this Monday, it's Michael Marks. Hello there, Michael.
Hey, David.
Was Sunday a beautiful day here in Central Texas? So it did. Was it just me? I mean, maybe it was just going outside. It just felt like an extraordinary day. It certainly wasn't the case for all of Texas, of course, but at least here in Central Texas, it was really kind of amazing.
Really exceptional, yeah. My wife and I took a drive just to get out of the house a little bit, get out and about, look at some wildflowers. Really, you're right, really gorgeous. It looked like it might get a little hairy. That's what the weather forecast said that evening, but we ended up faring better than folks in other parts of the state. I think we had some tornadoes elsewhere in Central Texas.
Right.
You mentioned those power outages in East Texas.
Yeah.
In Del Rio, did you get that photo that I sent your way?
You know, I did, and I didn't know what to make of it when I first saw it. It had what looked like an avocado, and beside that, what looked to my eyes like a small little white pumpkin. You know, a little...
Right.
I couldn't tell what it was. What was that?
So that was hail. That was softball-sized hail.
Good Lord.
I was dropping
avocado-sized hail or something. I don't
know. Yeah, yeah. You know, pick your produce. I mean, we're joking, but it really is. It really that
yeah.
Was, that has to
that
be
would
a
cause
terrifying
a ton of damage.
Experience.
Yeah.
You know, the hail that fell in Del Rio. That's what we were seeing. You know, Saturday night. On Twitter, there are just dozens of photos of folks who are either holding up that hail or showing pictures of the damage it caused. Unfortunately.
Oh boy.
Rosa Morales tweeted a photo of her car saying, "My windshield got busted out after the hail on Saturday." She is not alone. Lots of similar photos to that effect. This tweet from Lexus in Del Rio kind of sums it up. She's a senior in high school there. She says, "I think we all just need a break. First, we have the coronavirus, then our senior year being ruined, the lots of homework we're getting every week, and then this hailstorm that completely ruined most of our cars." Never a good time for a hailstorm. This is certainly right up there with the very worst times, though.
Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. You know, that was the only picture that I saw. But now that you're mentioning it, I'm going online here and seeing some of these videos that people shot down in South Texas. And it's astonishing how this stuff was just pummeling cars and trees and buildings. Unreal. Really awful.
Well, how about a bit of good news then, David?
I'm all ears.
Quickly related to what we heard in the roundup, you saw those photos of the huge lines of folks waiting to get food from San Antonio Food Bank.
Right.
Well, in response to that uptick in demand, Shea Serrano, he's a writer for The Ringer, San Antonio native. We've had him on the show. Mm-hmm. He launched a fundraiser through Twitter for the food bank, raised over $100,000 just last weekend. The food bank raised over $500,000 Friday alone. San Antonio Mayor Ron Nuremberg tweeted his thanks yesterday. He said, "Our city has to be among the most compassionate in the world. Thank you for your continued generosity." Serrano responded by asking the mayor for an official Shea Serrano Day, which is nothing if not shooting your shot. So a little, I'm sure all the local food banks could use a little lift out there, David.
Amen.
We should note.
Amen. And you heard what the folks said there from the different food banks, food organizations earlier in the broadcast. You know, they really could use your support right now. So if you have a little way that you can make a contribution, look them up and let them know how much you appreciate what they're doing for Texans in your neck of Texas. We're out of time for the big broadcast. We're going to be back here tomorrow, and we hope you'll join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family.